This should be very, very interesting tonight. Dr. Lee Bauman, author of God at the Speed of Light, The Melding of Science and Spirituality, Window to God, A Physician's Spiritual Pilgrimage, and The Akashic Light, Religion's Common Thread. Beginning his journey as a religious skeptic in the 1970s, Dr. Bauman now writes books defending spirituality based on the incredible link between worldwide descriptions of God and the proven scientific nature of physical light. It's going to be interesting. His first book was considered one of the inspirations for past CBS television series, Joan of Arcadia. Remember that? Lee has also been featured in the TV document, well, actually a couple of them, TV documentaries, The Evidence for Heaven and The Search for Heaven, both Grizzly Adams productions. Dr. Bauman, welcome to Coast AM.
Well, Art, thank you. It is a pleasure to be on Coast to Coast.
Is this your first visit?
To Coast to Coast, it is, yes.
Yes, I thought so. All right, Doctor, now that we have you introduced, I am going to take a very brief break, and we're going to dive into the material, all right?
Excellent.
Stay right where you are, and we'll be right back. Well, all right, Dr. Bauman, again, welcome back. And I would like to ask you, you know, I have interviewed probably hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors and scientists, and I find that the great percentage of them, when they're pressed right to the wall, which I do with a lot of them, don't believe in God at all.
Yes, I have found that to be exactly the case. I agree. And I think the reason for that, at least from my own experience, having gone through undergraduate school, where I personally was a biology major and a chemistry minor, and then, of course, we go through medical school, the scientific method basically mandates that if you cannot prove that something exists, then you have to doubt its true existence. And certainly that was where I found myself, and I think that's where most of my colleagues are right now. And certainly with theories such as Darwin's theory of evolution, you know, there, at least in the distant past, there were so many concepts which dictated against the existence of a higher being, and that was where I was in the mid-1970s.
What kind of doctor are you?
I am internal medicine and geriatrics.
Okay.
A medical doctor.
Yeah, quite clearly. And you've been a doctor for how long?
Oh, let's see. I graduated from medical school in 1976.
76.
So it's been about 30 years.
Yeah, for a while now.
Yeah.
Are you still actively practicing?
I am not. I got into administrative medicine, basically working for insurance companies back in 1990, and I've just slowly reduced my workload since that time, especially when I got into this writing. It has just been an overwhelming thrill to be able to influence, you know, so many people without the laying on of hands.
What made you decide to write a book?
Well, it was quite serendipitous. What happened back in the 1970s, and this was when I was actively practicing, I considered myself a religious skeptic, and I developed an interest because of Raymond Moody, who was another physician and philosopher who came out with the first published book on the near-death experience. Obviously, being a physician, that interested me. Both my wife, who was also a physician, and myself found ourselves, unfortunately, resuscitating people.
Mm-hmm.
And we always wondered, you know, what exactly was going on during the resuscitative process. We had a good idea what was going on from the medical and physiologic standpoint, but from the spiritual standpoint, of course, you learn absolutely nothing. And I guess that's because there's really nothing to learn. Nothing can be proven from that standpoint.
No. But there are things to learn. I mean,
there are.
There must have been some things that your patients said after being resuscitated, for example, that made you curious?
Well, yes. I had a few interesting cases. In particular, I remember when I was still a resident, actually, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I was called up on a floor to pronounce a patient, now pronounce them dead, that is.
Right.
And I went up, and being a resident, you know, still somewhat naive and not wishing to make any errors, I was just very complete in my examination of this poor individual. I examined the heart, made sure there were no heart sounds. I listened to the lungs to make sure they weren't breathing, and indeed that was the case. So I signed the papers and pronounced the patient dead. 30 minutes later, I was called back on the floor, and the nurses said, you know, Dr. Bauman, that patient you pronounced is now alert and talking.
Oh, my
and
God.
I said, what?
Yeah.
So that was my first introduction into this, you know, paranormal realm of what perhaps might be going on, so many things that we don't understand.
I'm curious about just that patient. How could that be? How could you find no signs of life? You said you were extra careful.
Yes.
And this guy was gone.
Well, you know, in retrospect, looking back on my research over the last 30 years, I think this type of thing is not that extraordinary. There are cases of near-death experiences, you know, throughout the ancient literature, and certainly you can find them on Amazon.com. In great quantity today, and I think that's exactly what happened, was this patient probably was dead for some unknown period of time, and for reasons that we just cannot explain, they came back.
Did this patient have anything to say? I mean, the nurse said he was alive and alert. Now, did he say, I've been somewhere, or I just woke up, I have no memory of what happened, or was it a heart attack, or I mean, what?
Well, actually, this patient had senile dementia, so they were not that coherent. You could not communicate well with them.
Uh-huh.
So I remember I checked on the patient to make sure that indeed they were alive, and, you know, this was the case. The patient was speaking, not very clearly. Well, from a communicative perspective, so I wasn't able to do any type of interview or find out exactly from that standpoint what had transpired. But
doesn't that bring into question? I mean, if you can really be careful and examine somebody and know they are dead, and then it turns out they're not dead, doesn't that honestly bring into question the whole? The whole question of when somebody really is dead?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's why we read so many stories about, in fact, one very interesting case that I discuss in God at the Speed of Light, where a patient lay in the hospital morgue in cold storage for like 3 days.
Oh, my
God. You know,
and
the pathologist came in and was getting ready to perform his autopsy when he noticed his eyelid move, and one thing led to another, and they ended up doing surgery, and the patient fully recovered. I think it happens more than we would like to admit.
Oh, lying in the morgue in cold storage for 3 days.
Yes.
That's awful.
Sends shivers up your spine, doesn't it?
It truly does. And I forget who it was. I was interviewing another physician who told me that in the very old days, they would actually bury people with a rope and a bell up top, so that in case they woke up, they could yank on this rope, and a bell would ring, and I guess whoever was overseeing the cemetery would dig them up.
Well, exactly. I've heard stories like that. The stories I've heard were more in relation at periods when narcolepsy was a real fear, when people would actually pass out and appear to be dead, which might, you know, go on for hours, if not longer, and these people would be buried. Of course, I would question how thorough that physical exam was at the time, but apart from that type of natural medical disorder, I think, you know, there still are cases where people have perhaps been buried when they might
still
have been
be alive. Is there anything in science that can explain no brain waves, no heart beating, no respirations, dead, and then 30 minutes, 2 hours, 5 hours, 3 days later, alive? Anything in science that can explain that?
To my knowledge, no. You know, the simple answer is no. I think various people can come up with hypotheses and theories as to why it perhaps was not detected, maybe just a very low blood pressure, a thready pulse that the physician could not detect, which is possible. Certainly in the intensive care unit, you would often have patients where their blood pressure was so low, the only way you could even detect a blood pressure or a pulse was through something called a Doppler or an ultrasound. That does happen. But usually these people there are ways to detect that they're still alive.
In your work, I know that you talk a lot about spiritual things. Do you go on past that to believe in the actual God of the Bible, or is there a line that you draw somewhere prior to that?
No. In fact, I feel very certain that the God of our Bible is the God of all religions. I basically preach a non-denominational type God. I was raised as a Christian, so I did come up through that philosophy. But truly, I believe that the God of all religions is the same God. And in fact, if you go and read every major spiritual scripture throughout the world, I find it so fascinating. How is God always described? And he or she is always described in terms of light. That was one of the eureka moments for me when, through my various research and reading into Einstein's theories of relativity, where light is really the cornerstone of that major concept, and then the near-death experience where the being of light is the main spiritual element of that phenomenon. And then, lo and behold, every major religion describes its God in terms of light. And I don't think those are just metaphors. I truly believe at this point in my life that they're literal.
You believe there is a relationship between light and consciousness, right?
Well, that came about not through my own theorizing. It actually came about through the words of physicists. I was not the one to actually term these particular words like consciousness for light. These were actually physicists, if you can believe that. So one thing led to another, and there is actually a series of experiments that shows that light alters its behavior based upon its surroundings. It's just incredible.
Well, certainly light, we all know light, well, I guess most of us know light is affected by, for example, gravity. It can bend light, right?
Yes, exactly.
Black holes can swallow light virtually or bend it.
Yes.
But I wasn't aware of a connection between light and consciousness. And I've been doing a great deal of talking and interviewing on the subject of consciousness. It's fascinating to me. But I've not heard anybody try to show a relationship between light and consciousness. So that's new for me. And I'd very much like to hear about it.
I think using the actual word consciousness is something that can be argued. But let me tell you how physicists actually came to coin that term for light. There was a series of experiments in the early 1900s known as the double slit series of experiments. And if you read about notables, including Nobel Prize winners like Richard Feynman, he discusses this experiment, the double slit experiment, which was the original experiment in the series. He describes it as being impossible. Those are his words, absolutely impossible. And the reason for that is in the original experiment, light is put through a series of steps, and they know what the final outcome of the experiment is. They then did a modification where they altered the very last step in the experiment, the very last step. What they found, to their utter amazement, was that light altered its actual behavior, its actual the pattern it was progressing through in the experiment. It altered its behavior in the middle of the experiment, far before it even got to the end where the changes were.
Yeah, I'm not grasping this yet. What exactly was the experiment?
Well, the experiment's rather complex, actually. They send a single photon or light wave into the experiment. It goes through some different channels, reflected off of mirrors and whatnot, and and then the outcome is measured at the end of the experiment. Now, in the modification at the end of the experiment, they put up some polarized pieces of glass so that they could actually detect the orientation of the photons at the very end of the experiment. Lo and behold, the light actually, I'm trying to put this in simple terms, but it altered its behavior before it even reached the polarized series of pieces of glass at the end. It actually altered where it was in space.
Its orientation? As in north, south, east, west?
That was part of it. Its polarization was part of the behavior change that was seen. To try to actually verbalize it, I find very difficult. Even when I go around the country giving my talks, it's so much easier to have a PowerPoint slide, you know, up on the screen where I can show all the
yes.
changes. But it's just a classic experiment, which, like I say, we have even Nobel Prize winners saying, this is impossible. But what you have to realize is it's impossible only for human beings where we are basically trapped in the four dimensions of the three dimensions of space and the fourth dimension of time. Light, for light, as difficult as it is to grasp this concept I'm about to say, time does not exist for light. And Einstein showed this. And it's been proven through particles known as muons that time does not exist for atomic
time particles. Does not exist for light.
It does not.
Well, I'm not quite sure I grasp that, because light has a specific speed, though that can be changed or affected, for example, as you mentioned, by gravity. We do have this speed of light thing, right?
Exactly, and that's where the confusion comes in. And
yeah, it is confusing, because it takes so long for light to get from point A to point B. We can measure that, right?
But see, the trick is that it's only... You're talking about human measurement of light.
Yes.
You have to realize that we are confined to four dimensions. And we live with time. We cannot escape time. And for us to try to talk about an entity like a photon or even any of the electromagnetic spectrum, these frequencies, these waves, they are not restricted by time. And that's where the difficulty comes in, because we cannot imagine something existing without time. And that's what happened with the double slit experiment. If you realize that these light waves were traveling around the experiment without regard to time, suddenly that makes sense. But
is that, you're telling me that's what the experiment proved, that it traveled in this experiment without regard to time?
Exactly. Exactly. And you know, the first experiment, the double slit experiment, was so, I mean, the results were so unpredictable that the physicists then developed a whole series of experiments afterwards.
All right, we'll talk about all that in a moment. We're hard up against a break here. Dr. Lee Bauman is my guest. Good morning or whatever. I'm Art Bell. Hi, everybody. Dr. Lee Bauman is my guest. And Tom Merry from Greeley, Colorado says, isn't it true that as one approaches the speed of light, time slows down, and as it reaches it, time actually stops as you get to the speed of light, time virtually stops. It's a question for Dr. Bauman in a moment. Dr. Bauman, okay, I'm struggling a little bit to understand this. It does seem as though as one approaches the speed of light, it slows down, that is, time slows down, and perhaps even stops as you get to the speed of light, yes?
That is absolutely correct. And, you know, I think Tom had it exactly. Time, you have to really come very close to the actual speed of light, even for time to begin to slow, at least from an appreciable standpoint. And once you actually reach light speed, time, at least according to the experiments that have been conducted up to date, will actually stop. And these concepts, you know, they're easy to phrase. It's easy to say time stops at light speed. But to actually accept that concept is very difficult. That's certainly one reason it took me 20 years to write my first book was you'd read about these concepts, you'd read about the experiments, but it's just so difficult for the human mind to accept. And that was where I was.
It really is. And what you're saying to us is that light operates outside of the realm of time altogether, really.
It does. It does. It's an incredible concept, but that's what actual physics and scientific experiments have proven.
All right. You mentioned Dr. Raymond Moody. I've interviewed Raymond, probably a couple dozen times over the years.
Yes,
he's an incredible guy. Have you personally ever experienced anything that you would consider to be really in the other than that patient you told me about, for example, anything that would be in the paranormal or supernatural arena?
Myself personally.
Yes, sir.
No, in fact, I consider myself. I use the term psychically deprived. Actually, I take that back. There was one point about 20 years ago where I woke up in the middle of the night, and I wasn't sure what woke me up, and I looked up. It was pitch black in the room, and I saw a white apparition, a form of a ghost dressed in Civil War, in a Civil War uniform.
No kidding.
And, of course, I didn't believe in ghosts, and I certainly there was nothing in medicine or science to give any credence to ghosts, so I blinked my eyes a couple of times, and he was still there, and I couldn't believe it. I felt, you know, for certain I just had something in my eye, and I blinked again, and sure enough, he was gone.
Uh-huh.
At that exact moment, my wife screams. She's in the bed next to me. She screams, which, honestly, she does on occasion when she's sleeping. She has nightmares, but anyway, she woke up, and I said, Brenda, are you all right? And she said, yes, I was being chased by a white apparition.
Wow.
And, you know, that has never recurred. And to this day, I don't know if it was just coincidence or if it was a meaningful experience.
For something like that, once will do.
It will.
That's really something. I would say the odds of that being a coincidence can't even be calculated.
But that is, you know, terming myself as psychically deprived except for that single experience.
I've only had a couple myself, a couple of things in my whole life. So I don't think for the average person they're normal, they're abnormal. That if you're lucky, you have one or two in your life, enough to know that it can happen.
Exactly. I agree with that.
Now, NDEs have endlessly fascinated me because if there is any, I guess, big question for all of us, and as we get older, it gets bigger, and that is whether there is an existence, a consciousness that continues after death.
Yes.
And NDEs sort of lead us down that path of how carefully have you looked at all this?
Well, NDEs do lead us down that path, and I think the work that Raymond Moody did, the Dr. Moody did, was just phenomenal. It was basically, I consider it a excellent medical study. The fact that there were so many elements which occurred repetitively and were mm-hmm. often corroborated by some of these out-of-body experiences by people who were observed during the experience but obviously didn't know they were being observed, and they could actually state, yes, I was doing this at that time. I just find are phenomenal. And I don't think they can be just negated, you know, by skeptics. I think there's a lot of credibility to these observations. And the fact that many people say, well, drugs caused this or oxygen deprivation caused it,
that's right.
I don't buy that, because so many people, such as my wife would often tell about in the emergency room, you know, these people would go out right there on the litter. They'd be talking to you 1 minute, and then they were gone the next. You resuscitated them, and they would come back without the use of drugs, and the amount of time that they were gone would have, you know, sometimes was just a phenomenally short time, maybe 5, 10, 15 seconds, mm-hmm. and they're back. And these people would have similar experiences that you couldn't argue were the result of drugs or oxygen deprivation. And yet these people would often be just as bitter and angry that they were brought back from this state of euphoria and this, existence on the other side.
Well, if you have heard these things from your patients, and your wife has,
yes,
that must mean that most physicians, emergency room physicians and so forth, have the same experience fairly frequently, and they don't talk about it.
Well, they don't talk about it. And as we alluded to earlier in the conversation, many of these people are indeed atheists and agnostics, and they cannot understand in the least how these young people, you know, people with everything in the future to look forward to, would come back and be upset that they were brought back from the dead. You know, to them, least of all, does it make any sense. To someone like me, who am now very spiritual, I think it makes, you know, excellent sense. But for an atheist, you know, to be challenged in the emergency room with such bitterness and anger, they have real difficulty accepting that.
God at the Speed of Light, your book, apparently helped to inspire CBS's Joan of Arcadia. How did all that occur?
Well, that's an interesting story. I was just on the Internet one day back in the fall of 2003, and my name came up on one of these search engines under the heading of a TV show. And so I had to check it out, find out, you know, what this was all about. And lo and behold, here was this very prestigious Hollywood producer and director who named my book as one of the books that she had read and had inspired her to create this TV series. Now, you have to think back. I was a first-time author and, you know, still quite naive as to all the transpirings that often occur following, you know, even a modestly successful book. And I just couldn't believe it. I felt sure that she had the name wrong, and somehow things had gotten messed up, and it wasn't me at all, or it wasn't my book at all. But as I went on and read about it, indeed, the TV show dealt with spirituality, and the character was kind of a tangent or an offshoot off of the character Joan of Arc, who would often see God in this TV series. So I was very flattered. It was quite a thrilling experience for me.
I'm sure it was. Now, I want to talk a little more about consciousness. Are you familiar with the work going on at Princeton in, you know, with respect to consciousness?
You would probably have to give me more information. The simple answer would be no, but
Okay. In a nutshell, then, what they're doing at Princeton is they have this a great big computer, and then they have computers all over the world, Doctor. You're going to have to look into this, and they dub them eggs, It has a scientific meaning, but they call them eggs, and they are simply computers geographically scattered around the world, and they're sitting there spitting out random numbers. And each one of these computers reports back to the mama computer at Princeton. And as an example, and there are many examples now going back years, but I'll give you the example of 9/11. They record constantly, kind of like you're looking for an earthquake. And they depend on these computers to be continually spitting out random numbers. Well, when something starts to get non-random, it is recorded almost as though you would record an earthquake. And with major events that have occurred in the world, like 9/11, the non-random aspect of it just went right off the chart. I mean, it just went boom. All of a sudden, about, get this now, 30 minutes before 9/11 actually happened, it just went off the chart. And that relates to many, many, many big things that have happened in the world. This has been going on for a number of years now at Princeton. You can actually go on the web and put in Princeton Consciousness Project or Princeton Eggs, and you can actually look at these computers in different parts of the world reporting back to Princeton. And it seems as though human consciousness appears to be affecting these computers to begin to go non-random. There's something in human consciousness that's affecting these computers. And it appears to be outside of time. In other words,
yes.
Prior to these events, 30 minutes or so, everything starts going berserk. Now, how can that be?
You know, 30 years ago, I would have dismissed such experiments as, you know,
nonsense.
As nonsense, or there was a explanation lying out there somewhere. We would just find it, eventually. But anymore, no, I do not believe in accidents anymore. So that does not shock me as much as many might think it would.
Oh, doctor, this is serious research. It's been going on for some time, and because of the work you're doing, you've absolutely got to look into this. It's fascinating stuff.
I will do that.
Been going on for years. So there's something outside of time with respect to human consciousness itself, which I guess would key into what you're saying with light being outside of the time spectrum.
Exactly. And Art, there is something I would like to say to you and the listeners out there. I want you to understand, I am not the type of person that feels at this point in my life that I have all the answers. I am still learning. And, you know, my books do offer an explanation for a higher being in the universe, but I do want everyone to understand I am still learning. And I by no means do have all the answers. I have found some very interesting relationships between physical light and attributes that we have ascribed to God throughout the millennia, and I think there is a significant connection, but I do not have all the answers. So none of us do. That's just a point I do wish to throw in there.
Well, point made. None of us have all the answers.
Well, some people think they do.
Yeah, I know, but I disregard those people.
Right.
Have you looked into NDEs, I guess, fairly carefully behind Dr. Moody, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
When you study his work and other work that people have done with NDEs, does it bring you to the conclusion positively in your mind that there is consciousness following physical death?
Yes, yes, and I have no doubt of that whatsoever. Now, back in the 1970s, I could not accept the tenet of God based upon faith alone. In fact, looking through my life, I probably never could. And that was how science has actually brought me to that point in my life, where now I just feel there is no doubt whatsoever. And science is the basis for that, including Moody's work with the near-death experience, where as you read the various near-death experiences which are out there, the main element of the near-death experience is undoubtedly when the person undergoing the experience first is introduced to this being of light, or to the light itself. The spirituality associated with it, the peace, the love, the warmth, that has been what has transpired or changed most people's lives who have undergone this type of event. So, yes, I feel the near-death experience is a definite, very good argument for why consciousness exists following death.
It's a good argument. I'm still kind of a skeptic. I unless I can absolutely prove something, and NDEs come close, but you know, it's I still somewhere in my mind I say, well, this could be a dying brain. Now I've seen physicians stand up on television specials and say, look, it's the brain dying from the outside, moving inward. Brain cells dying on the outside of the brain, finally moving inward until you begin to get to the core, the middle of the brain, and what people see as this light at the end of a what appears to be a long tunnel is merely the last part of the brain that has not yet died. And for those few that come back, that's the experience they relate, and that's why they relate it. And you dismiss that. Why?
I have read those accounts, I have heard the arguments, but I don't buy it. If you research the dying brain, it has so many similarities to when you're put under general anesthesia, is the typical scenario that I like to bring forth. If you undergo general anesthesia, you know, you're laying there on the table and the anesthetist is telling you to count backwards, and you know what happens is everything goes black. It's not that they see light, everything goes black.
That's right.
And there is absolutely no medical or physiologic explanation for why the dying brain should see light. There are too many occurrences where people undergo unconsciousness or they're put out under general anesthesia, and the typical scenario you hear is everything goes black. It's not that they see light. So that, at least from a medical standpoint, is why I just cannot buy those arguments.
It always went black for me. I've been under a few times, and it definitely went black. I didn't see any light. All right. There are multiple descriptions of God. You say, in terms of light in the Bible, and other religious texts.
Yes.
What kind of descriptions lead you, or where do you see this in Scripture where it refers to light other than let there be?
I can give you multiple examples if you would like.
I would like.
Well, certainly, you know, Christ says, "I am the light of the world" in the New Testament, and you see similar descriptions in other Christian books like the Book of Mormon. Let's see, God is the Blessed One. The Blessed One is the light and the moon and the sun. Mm-hmm. And that's in the Bhagavad Gita. In the Quran, God is described as the light of the heavens and the earth. Brahma, from the Upanishads, the Indian Upanishads, is described as the light of lights. The clear light of pure reality describes nirvana in the Buddhist Tibetan Book of the Dead.
So God equals light.
Yes, and it goes on and on like that.
All right, but we can't. We're at a break point.
I understand.
Hold tight, Doctor. Top of the hour. Take a nice deep breath, and we'll come back and continue. Dr. Lee Bauman is my guest. In the darkness at the moment here in the high desert... How you doing, everybody? I'm Art Bell.